This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, sitting in for Steve Inskeep. The labor market is expected to remain tough for many months. When jobs eventually start coming back, some areas may recover long before others. For example, healthcare and education could bounce back quickly. Construction jobs, on the other hand, could take years to return. And as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports, there are some fields where jobs are most likely gone for good.
It's the week before classes at Maryland's Montgomery College, and business at the registration office is booming.
My bill says I have a class here, but I'm not taking it.
Oh, I need to get some transcripts.
Sure.
I was told if I filled this paper out, I can get my ID now.
Most sectors of the economy shrink during a recession, but not community colleges like Montgomery. In the last academic year, the college hired more than 200 people. Enrollment for credit is expected to pass 25,000 this fall, an all-time high. Vivian Lawyer runs Human Resources.
When the economy is bad, community colleges tend to grow in enrollments because people are coming back to school to shore up their skills in various areas or to retool.
The college plans to add at least another 20 faculty this academic year.
My name is Antonio del Castillo. I'm an associate professor in biology.
Del Castillo is one of Montgomery's recent hires. He used to do government-sponsored research. Then his boss lost funding.
He was told that he had to leave that institution, and then all the people that work for him has to start looking. At that moment in time, I thought that, okay, I need to find something more stable.
Oh, 911. I think he needs to be here because he is a cardiac patient.
Another area where jobs are expected to grow is healthcare. Bill Robertson runs Adventist Healthcare, which has hospitals in Maryland and New Jersey. He says during the recession, Adventist continued to hire pharmacists, physical therapists, and ultrasound technicians.
At one of our hospitals, Washington Adventist Hospital, we have one of the largest orientations of new graduate nurses going on. I think we have 24 nursing graduates in orientation right now.
The nation's population continues to grow and age. To meet those needs locally, Adventist plans to hire another 700 people in the next 2 years. Robertson says a recession won't stop the growth in healthcare.
When you look at a 25 or 50-year horizon, which is what we have to plan on, we're always looking to say that this is going to be a growing community, and a downturn for a year or two or three does not ultimately change the vision.
Other job sectors, though, are expected to lag in any recovery. One is manufacturing. Technology, global competition, and outsourcing have destroyed jobs in industries such as autos and furniture. John Graham teaches finance at Duke and runs a business tracking survey with CFO Magazine.
Those jobs are unlikely to come back even when demand picks up because the labor is cheaper outside of the United States.
Another expected lagger, construction. Josh Bivens works for the Economic Policy Institute, a labor think tank in Washington, D.C. He says about 200,000 construction jobs should not have existed in the first place. They were created by the housing bubble. Bivens thinks buyers will have to work through the glut of foreclosed homes before builders can really start hiring again.
It's just going to take time. It's just going to take an economic recovery, but also kind of the natural process of population growth, actually more people physically needing more homes to live in. And I don't think there's anything that will really speed that up.
Will be big layoffs at Morgan Stanley. And
Bear Stearns could start to hand out thousands of pink slips this week.
The big New York investment bank Lehman Brothers has announced it will file for bankruptcy.
Aside from housing, the other field that sparked the recession was finance. Innovative products like mortgage-backed securities blew up and brought investment banks to their knees. But Jonathan Shepard says he's beginning to see a turnaround.
Every day I talk to people who are hiring or looking to hire. Absolutely.
Shepard works for Harvard Business School, where he hooks students up with financial firms. He says companies have cut so deep, they will have to bring on more staff as the economy improves.
There have been hundreds of thousands of people in the financial services industry who have been let go. So there's clearly room for some significant hiring.
Shepard says after crashes, people always ask the same question.
Is finance dead? Will it ever come back? Will anyone ever make any creative innovation? And time and again, I think the answer is, you know, yes, it comes back. Yes, it evolves. I wouldn't bet against the financial services industry.
Overall, the road to job recovery will be a long one. There are nearly 7 million fewer jobs today than at the start of the downturn. And the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a Washington think tank, has this prediction. The unemployment rate will not return to pre-recession levels until 2014. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. The novel Hunger Games has spent 50 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list for kids' chapter books. It takes the concept of the reality show to an extreme. In the future, 24 young people are forced to fight each other to the death in an annual televised ritual. Hunger Games is the first book in a planned trilogy. The eagerly awaited second book, Catching Fire, comes out this week. NPR's Lynn Neary talked with the author.
As a child, Suzanne Collins was obsessed with Greek mythology, and one of her favorites was the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur. She was struck by the cruel punishment that Crete had imposed on Athens for being on the wrong side of a war. Every year, the Athenians had to send 7 young men and 7 maidens to be thrown into the labyrinth and devoured by the Minotaur.
And even when I was a child, I was blown away by how evil that was. It was like Crete was sending this very clear message, which was, if you mess with us, we'll do something worse than kill you. We will kill your children.
In Collins' story, 24 young men and women from 12 districts in what was once North America, but is now a country called Panem, are sent to the Hunger Games every year as punishment for a war that happened 75 years ago. Collins says her idea for the book began to form one night while she channel surfed. On one channel, she saw images of kids fighting in a real war. On another, young people were competing for money in a reality TV show.
If you take elements of the two types of programming I was watching, reality television and war coverage, competition, fighting to the death, entertainment, violence, audience participation, what you come up with is a gladiator game.
Collins remembered the gladiator movies that were popular when she was young, most notably Spartacus, the story of a slave who led an unsuccessful but heroic rebellion. One scene in that film has become iconic. The defeated slaves have been told they will not be punished as long as they turn in their leader. As Spartacus stands up to identify himself, the others join in one last act of defiance to protect him.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
Collins uses a similar image in Catching Fire. The heroine of the trilogy, 16-year-old Katniss Everdeen, won the Hunger Games, but she also defied the all-powerful government during the competition with symbolic gestures and actions. In doing so, she has inspired the stirrings of rebellion across the country. In this excerpt from the book, Katniss appears before a crowd during a government-sponsored victory tour.
What happens next is not an accident. It is too well executed to be spontaneous because it happens in complete unison. Every person in the crowd presses the 3 middle fingers of their left hand against their lips and extends it to me. It is our sign from District 12, the last goodbye I gave Rue in the arena. If I hadn't spoken to President Snow, this gesture might move me to tears. But with his recent orders to calm the districts fresh in my ears, it fills me with dread.
Only gradually, says Collins, does Katniss begin to understand that she has become a symbol of the spreading rebellion.
It's this awakening. This is not one who, a character who starts out as this hot-headed rebel. This is someone who has, you know, rebel status thrust upon her, and is not always comfortable with it, did not plan on it, but eventually is able to carry it.
Collins lures in young readers of both genders with a suspenseful plot, nonstop action, and even a love triangle. But she does not hold back on the violence inherent in her story, nor does she apologize for it. Violence, she says, finds its way into young lives, whether we like it or not. Children's literature expert Anita Silvey says the violence in the books is a reflection of what's happening in the culture.
Reality TV has gone lower and lower every season. We are sending our young people, you know, over to the other side of the world to kill young people. And children and teens are killing each other in schools. When you realize that she has all those elements to throw into the cauldron of story, I don't think it's surprising that a book like The Hunger Games comes out of that.
Collins believes her target audience, kids just entering adolescence, is just the right age to take on the challenge that underlies her story.
They are themselves beginning to question authority. And they are themselves beginning to look at government and situations throughout the world and wonder if they're moral or not. And you have to have that. You have to, at some time in your life, begin to question the environment, the political situation around you, and decide, you know, whether it's right or not, and if it isn't, what part you're going to play in that.
The story of the rebellion, which was ignited in the first book and has begun spreading and catching fire, will likely grow more important as the trilogy draws to a close. Collins is already hard at work on that final book, even as her young readers are just cracking open the latest chapter of her story. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Muhammad Ali was in Ireland yesterday, there to visit the western Irish town of Ennis. That was the home of his great-grandfather, who immigrated to the United States in the 1860s. Thousands turned out to welcome Ali, including veteran Irish boxers who sparred with him years ago. He went to Ireland after a visit to England. Commentator Frank DeFord says reactions there in general to the boxing legend were mixed.
Muhammad Ali flew to England last week there to make appearances in soccer stadiums. He said it would probably be his last time in the UK. He can barely move on his own now. One London newspaper called Ali, he who was once a butterfly, little more than a zombie. And a great many people find it upsetting, as it is sad, that the old champ continues to make personal appearances. Maybe it would have been best if our last image of him had been in 96, when he suddenly appeared out of nowhere and, already shaking terribly from Parkinson's, he still managed to light the Olympic flame. There was a nobility to that scene, as if once more he'd gotten off the canvas, managed somehow to win another fight. But Ali wouldn't retire from the ring when he should have, and now he refuses to comfort us and slip away from public view. Perhaps there's a bolder statement in that, that the man who once so immodestly enjoyed standing before us, the laird of his realm, proclaiming his beauty to the heavens, is now unafraid to let us see him when his great body is slumped in shambles. But might we be too tender with our memories? The athlete dying young has always seemed so shocking, so unfair. But I suspect that it upsets us even more to actually see our heroes, those physical marvels, grown old and infirm, as vulnerable to age and disease as we ordinary folk are. We want to remember the paragon, not the mere human. Ah, but in contradiction, Ali's wife Lonnie speaks for her husband, saying that for as long as he can manage to travel and make silent appearances, it is not just his living, it is his life. There must for Ali be as much in satisfaction as in remuneration that he can still command up to $100,000 just for showing up. The busted old pug was long a stereotype in our athletic cavalcade. That Ali is broken but not broke is a certain revenge, and he who was once so reviled by so many Americans has become quite a beloved figure in his dotage. Complicated as he has been, he won the fight for our affection, too. I can so vividly remember a few years ago when a photographer posed him before the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. I thought that was insane. Who, after all, was more identified with opposition to that war? But when the people there, searching for the names of their loved ones, those who had died for what Ali opposed, when they spotted him, they rushed to him, even handed me their little cameras to take snapshots with him, embraced him. It was dear. Even as boxing as a sport fades to the fringes, Muhammad Ali still retains some kind of hold on us. If he yet wants to present his present lesser self to us, it is not for us to feel pity for him.
Frank DeFord joins us each week from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.